There's a lot of things going on.
This is a very zany kind of game.
It was ahead of its time.
It's really clever what they've done.
It's tense, but it's very brain melty.
It's kind of a mix of everything I love in trick taking.
Welcome to Trick Talkers, your favorite podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Patrick.
And tonight's episode is brought to you by all of our lovely Patreon supporters. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
So tonight's episode, we were thinking about covering a lot of two-player games. Patrick and I, we were able to get in a game night where we just played some two-player only trick takers, and we wanted to talk about our experience about those, as well as some other two-player ones that we have played, and then have an even deeper dive comparison on two games a little bit later.
Yeah, so we've got a few lovely two-player games for you all tonight. One of them, the first one, is Fox in the Forest, one of the more recent trick takers from 2017. In that game, two players are playing cards, two tricks. Would you believe it, Ryan? Yeah.
We're going to say who it's by.
Oh, we're going to say who it's by. Yeah, it's not by a bunch of foxes, apparently. I was told wrong. I got the wrong memo. The Fox in the Forest is by Joshua Burgell. I think it is Burgell. And this is, again, another episode with my pronunciations. Go out the window. Joshua Burgell. Apologies if I said your name wrong. Fox in the Forest. Bunch of foxes. Coming back to it.
Dude, got distracted there.
Got distracted by the foxes. You foxed me.
I did.
But basically, you don't want to take too many tricks, because if you get greedy, you find yourself on a slippery slope. There are 13 potential tricks, and the idea is to get a balance. So there's different descriptions, and believe it or not, taking 13 tricks, Ryan apparently is greedy. Also, if you take no tricks or just a few tricks, you're regarded as humble. And I suppose, Ryan, that would be you in your case, because you're a pretty humble guy and you like to shoot the moon, right?
I don't know about the humble part, but I certainly go for the least amount of tricks in that game every time I play. Even when I see the highest numbers in my hand, I'm still trying to find a way to take the least amount of tricks.
He likes the challenge. Mm-hmm. So the kind of middle ground is where you are classed as defeated. So you want to take between 7 and 9 tricks. That's the sweet spot. But to cut to the chase, this game is a lot of fun because all the cards do different things. Certain cards have certain abilities on them. So, for example, there's a card where if you play it and you lose the trick, you can still lead the next trick. Trick-taking games can live or die on controlling the leading of tricks. So there's some neat mechanics in there to mitigate your luck and really make good of whatever hand you're given.
I know a lot of games, you know, people hear or see powers and think, oh, that's going to make it too crazy. That's going to make it too chaotic. I don't like powers in my card games. I think Fox in the Forest does a good job at having just a little bit in there and making only a few cards do things than having every single card do something.
Yeah, it did seem quite, well, it's been a while since I played Fox in the Forest. I will caveat, but it did seem quite balanced. I think you're right with the cards. And it's just this whole trick avoidance or winning tricks. You have to pivot and adjust to the tempo of the game. There's not one card that kind of does it all, because everybody's, the players aren't necessarily going for the same amount of tricks.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes that one a nice sort of puzzle. Mm-hmm. Because when you first look at your hand that you're dealt, you almost have to decide it early on. Are you going to go for the high number of tricks? You're going to go for the low number of tricks? Because you never want the middle number.
Right.
And having a couple powers that let you exchange cards can always be nice, because now you're entering new cards into your hand that you might not have had before. But ultimately, most of your hand's going to be with you the entire round. And sometimes you might win tricks you weren't expecting to win. And there's a trump suit. There's only 3 suits in the game. If you're long suited in something, especially the trump suit, you might see yourself winning a lot of tricks. But you can't, like you said, win too many and be greedy. So you got to find a way to try and swap that and get your opponent to start winning those tricks. And I think it's a really neat head-to-head trick taker.
Yeah, it's quite fluid. You can't be stuck in your ways because you have to adjust to what your opponent's doing. And I think that's one of the nice things. You might suddenly think, right, I'm going to go for no tricks. And then panic washes over you halfway through your hand. And you think, oh, actually, now I need to go for it. And that's why you can get caught out in this middle ground, like you were saying, Ryan. So quite tense as well. It kind of gives you the feel, the adrenaline rush as you're playing. It's not mundane by any means. So I think it's a very, very good two-player trick taker.
Certainly. And if you're looking for a similar game that has the same name and similar art style, but is on the cooperative side of things, there is the Fox in the Forest Duet. This is actually designed by, the credit is given to Foxtrot Games. I know the original designer, Josh Bergel, had some part or helped a little bit in the Fox in the Forest Duet. So I don't know at what point it became Foxtrot Games or whatever. But either way, it has similar idea where some cards in the game have powers. And what you're trying to do is remove these gems from a little board that's in the middle of the table. And the sort of thematic bit is that there was a prince and princess that were on their way and their carriage dropped gems off in the forest. And you guys are foxes trying to pick those gems up. So you're doing this by playing your cards and the winner of the trick will move towards themselves. And you're trying to stomp on these spaces to pick up all the gems. And as long as you can pick all of them up, you'll win the game. And there's three different difficulty levels, A, B, and C, I think they are. And the A difficulty is a great start, but I know like the C level, it's almost you have to be perfect. Like when you win a trick, if you move your piece onto a space that doesn't have a gem, then I think you only can do it like two or three times.
Yeah.
After you've missed that, it's just like it's impossible to win because you don't have enough tricks to pick up enough pieces. So it gets really tight and it becomes a really, really interesting puzzle.
It's almost like it was almost like you were telling me a bedtime story for me. You know, the princess, the prince, the carriage. You know, is this a reiteration of Cinderella? I like it. But in all seriousness, it does sound quite intriguing. I like the sound of the puzzle and the different difficulty levels. From what you're saying, Ryan, then, you know, one has you playing almost perfectly to achieve it and one is kind of a nice introduction. What's your preferred way to play then? Do you sort of go for the middle difficulty level or are you...
Well, I think the game, it's designed perfectly to ramp yourself up.
Okay.
And so actually, before the pandemic, I used to work downtown. I live in Pittsburgh. And I used to have a coworker that played board games as well. And we would play Fox in the Forest Duet and Haggis, which is a fantastic climbing shedding game by Sean Ross that works really well at two players. But anyways, Fox in the Forest Duet, we would play this every day at lunch for probably like 2 or 3 months. And we started to get really good at it. So like we would play a lot though, like early on trying to like, you know, mind meld with each other and kind of figure out our play styles and how we would do what in certain situations. And the more we played, the more we started to realize like, okay, when, you know, this is the trump suit and when we are starting in this area and we have this many diamonds, this is kind of how we're going to play it out. Might not always work because obviously the random deal, but we were on the same wavelength of how we would do it. So then we started to graduate further on, and then we were only playing the C and trying to beat it perfectly. We did it a couple times, but we certainly lost more than we won.
Well, you were the A team historically, that's safe to say. had to get that in. But the only other question I've got with it, because I've at the original Fox in the Forest, not played Duet, sounds really interesting. Does it come with a real a carriage piece that you move along a board?
No, it's just a little orange disc that slide back and forth, yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could use your imagination, but I like the sound of it. It sounds like a good little puzzle, and actually, just to come to that, depending on the play style, because obviously this is with two people, me and my partner, when we play games, she generally doesn't like it, you know, negative interaction as much. So I feel like if I were to choose between, you know, the two games, Fox in the Forest and Duet, that potentially, if think about the person you're playing with, it's nice that there's the games are very similar, but there's a co-op option and there's this head-to-head stuff. So I think that's a way of owning the game with a great theme, but also thinking about the player.
Certainly giving both options based on your mood or your tastes at the time, for sure. To
exactly.
Still similar feel, but competitive versus cooperative. And the nice thing is, if you own both, they easily fit in one box.
Wow. Okay, so it really is a duo in your box, though. That's great. It lives up to its name. Next up is Sail, originally known as, well, the Japanese version is Hamlin Cave, by Akiyama Koyo and Kozu Yusei, I think, is the pronunciation. Anyway, Hamlin Cave is one game that always goes down well whenever I play it. It is frighteningly difficult at the harder levels, but like with Fox in the Forest Duet, has variable difficulty, which is one of the good things about Hamlin Cave. Essentially, you're trying to steer a pirate ship through the a cave and avoiding the obstacles in the cave, befriending mermaids along the way to help give you a boost, and also being mindful of there's a ghost timer. So there is a ghost deck of cards that if you ever find yourself not defeating the ghosts, then you succumb to their scary nature and lose the game. I don't know if that's the best way
The ghost pirates are coming to attack your ship. You've been overrun by the ghost pirates.
Yeah, I think I said it in a very British, weird way.
But that's basically, okay. I think we're all used to your weird, interesting Briticisms.
Probably right. But yeah, so it's a lovely little puzzle in a co-op nature. And you, depending on the cards that you both play, irrespective of whether somebody plays offsuit or not, there is interactions that can happen. So, for example, two mermaids come out, and that's quite hard to pull off because it's a must-follow game and the two mermaids are of different suits. The boat gets a bit more of a boost. Two swords, you can kill a ghost, for example. And it's all these kind of interactions. You do get to pass a card to your teammate at the start. Is it one card or two cards? Ryan, it escapes me, but
it's one card.
One card. And you also get a little character as well. And it's kind of with an asymmetrical ability on it that lets you break the rules at some point during a round or throughout the game. Very, very quirky and was very, very difficult to find, actually, up until recently, right?
Yeah, with the new Sail Kickstarter coming from Allplay, this game is significantly more available. And, well, once it does fulfill, the Kickstarter only just ended like a week or two ago, but they did make some updates and some changes to it a little bit. It's no longer ghost pirates you're fighting. It's a Kraken that you're fighting against. They did add a couple new characters and a couple new tiles that have new abilities, which I'm actually really interested in seeing how they play. But I think the biggest difference is Hamlin Cave, the boards were double-sided, and depending on how you oriented them would determine your difficulty level. There was 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and everything was like printed on the board itself. So the little rocks, that symbols that were on the board were stationary. You couldn't move them. But with Sail, they gave you blank boards and then little tokens that you put on the board. So they give you like a setup picture for the different levels, but it also allows you to make your own custom levels, which is sort of a double-edged sword, to me at least, I think, because while the customization is amazing, and that's super cool to be able to allow yourself to make any level you want, the fact that it's just more setup time and a little bit fiddly to have all those pieces everywhere, and I know they even added the upgrade bits that are like 3D meeple pieces.
Yeah,
which look great, but for playability and visibility, it's just there's so much going on. Like there's the picture on the Kickstarter. They show you with the flat pieces, and then they like pan to what it looks like with the meeple bits on it. And like you lose the playership that you are. And also the spots that have the little like Kraken symbol, your ship can actually move on to. But the 3D pieces is like a tentacle that you can't really put your ship on. So it's just like, I get why they did it, because they're doing upgrades for all their games and they look pretty. And I mean, obviously I got them. My plan is I'm going to use them as a mini expansion for Crash Octopus, which is a great dexterity game.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But anyways, it's still a good update to that game. I don't think it's horrible in any way, but I can see most people probably not using the upgrades more than they might have expected. And I know that bundle they had for all four games was like absurdly good to get all the upgrades in all four games at once. So there's probably a lot of people that are just going to get the upgrades and then they're just going to sit in a bag off to the side, because I'd have to imagine they're not going to be able to fit back in the box.
Well, good luck with it. I mean, my opinion is, Ryan, as someone who owns Hamblin Cave, and I'm obviously unbiased, as you know, I've seen this new Kickstarter for sale, looks good. I like the idea of the modular board. I agree it may add to the fiddliness of the setup. Also, of course, the official scenarios, which are perfectly playable with the new version of Sail, have the benefit of being tried and tested and balanced. And, you know, we, albeit the later difficulty levels in Hamblin Cave are frighteningly difficult. So I know they've made some tweaks and they've thought about the balance here. I have some concerns that if I was making my own levels, they would be very off the wall and very unbalanced. Fun, yeah. But balance, I don't know. I don't trust myself to construct a cave.
Well, and I think that's the beauty with the community, though.
Yeah.
I think you'll see in BGG forum posts or on Reddit or somewhere, people putting their setups. And I'm almost certain there's going to be somebody who's going to make a campaign story out of it, where they have different maps of, this is your first one, and then if you lose you'll play on this map, if you win you'd play on this map, and it'll sort of have like branching paths. I'm almost certain we'll see something like that at some point in the future.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, like you've seen with other games in Quest for El Dorado, etc., the people just kind of love making content for these games.
Yeah.
I also think you had a point with the wooden figures and passing the board. That is a concern for me in gameplay. So, but that doesn't matter because obviously your mileage may vary. And at the end of the day, regardless of whether you've got a copy of Crash Octopus and you fancy using the pieces for that, you're still going to get the cardboard pieces, the modular stuff. So you're not losing out on that. And notwithstanding the fact that Hamblin Cave is, as I said, very difficult to find. So if I was starting fresh today and saw Sail, then I think you can't really go wrong. There aren't ghosts, but, you know, at the end of the day, there is a Kraken. So, you know, decide based on your own preferences, really, what you prefer.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, moving on to the next one here is Awimbaway. And this is designed by Matthew Roussel. It caught me off guard, actually. So based on just a rules read and kind of looking at it, I didn't expect as much from this game as when I actually played it. So Awimbaway has this thing where you deal out your hand normally, that, you know, dealt 6 cards each player, and they put it in their hand and keep it hidden from their opponent. But then there are also 4 cards that are dealt face down on the table, with 4 more cards that are dealt face up on top of those, 2 each player. So there's 8 cards in total in front of each player, 4 face up, 4 face down. And those 4 cards that are face up are a part of your hand. So when you are to play a card, you can play one of the 6 cards that's hidden in your hand, or one of the 4 cards that's face up on the table. And your opponent knows those 4 cards you have. So if your opponent's leading and they can see 2 green cards face up on the table in front of you, because it is a must follow trick taker. So if they play green, you're forced to play green. They know you have 2 green cards because they're face up, but you might also have green cards in your hand. So you could choose to play one from your hand and give them new information, or you just play one of the ones face up on the table to keep that hand information hidden for just a little bit longer. And then once you play one of those cards from the table, that card that's underneath gets flipped face up at the end of the trick. And this is a game that has powers as well. Certain things, certain cards you play will trigger certain abilities. There's the classic, the lowest card of a suit beats the highest card of a suit if they're in the same trick. There's another one where you get to choose who leads the next trick, regardless of who won it. There's the, I think the greatest part of the game, because it's one of the ways the round can end, is the hyenas. They're worth, they're one of the cards that's worth the most points. And if you manage to get all four of them, you immediately lose the round and your opponent wins instead. And this is just a best 2 out of 3 game. So if no player gets all four hyenas, then both players count the number of crowns they took in their trick piles throughout the round. So certain animals will have 0, 1, 2, or 3 crowns on them. So there's this sort of push-pull about which cards you're trying to get and trying to get the most crowns, but also not get stuck with all four hyenas.
Yeah, if you get stuck with the hyenas, your opponent's surely going to be laughing, right? Because that's what hyenas do, Ryan. They laugh. I like the sound of the straw. I know this is a wide term used.
The straw man?
Straw man mechanic, right? We're not talking Wizard of Oz. We're talking literally cards face down on the table and then other cards on top of them face up, playing them out. And then as you do, you know, the card underneath getting revealed. Someone who I know likes the straw man mechanic is Sean Ross. And we see it in other games of his like Madrasso, etc. But without coming away from, you know, a Wimbleway too much, very cool sounding with the animals. It's one that I saw, you know, earlier last year. Intended to pick it up and play it, never got round to it. Sounds like one I should really give a go then, Ryan.
I would highly recommend it. I know you're limited to your 8 purchases left for the year. Yeah. So I don't know if this one hits the spot of making one of those 8.
Okay.
But I will definitely say for me, it was a surprise purchase. It's like $8 or $9 on Philibert. So when somebody was already making an order, split the shipping, like it just made sense to me to grab it, and I'm glad I did. But the straw man part of it is super cool, deciding when to play those cards face up, revealing new face the face down cards and getting those into play, especially because again those abilities that'll trigger, knowing what cards are hidden or trying to find out what cards are hidden, maybe getting them revealed earlier in the round can be helpful. Because the other thing I didn't mention is there's an eagle suit. And the eagle suit is essentially the trump suit in the game, where if you can't follow the lead suit, you must play an eagle card.
Oh, I must trump. Interesting.
Yes, and so yeah. You must trump. But the way the eagle cards work is also neat. It's not just a automatic trump, you win the trick. You can choose to fight or flee, as they call it in the rules. Where if you choose to fight, it acts as a normal trump card. You win the trick and you take both cards. But if you choose to flee, you just take the eagle card and your opponent takes the card they played. So depending on what it is that they play, such as the hyena or something else that you might not want to take into your pile, it makes a neat play on the forced must trump, but you don't actually want to at certain times. Because the thing is, the eagles are also negative points. They have negative crowns on them.
Right. So you know, you've got the power, as they say, but then that power comes with responsibilities, right? Because the negative points.
Certainly does.
Yeah. I quite like to play it and potentially put the Lion King soundtrack on in the background. And
Speaking of animals,
do we like cats? Maybe. Catchy, designer Yuko, is a tug of war game. And by that, I mean you're trying to attract the cat. Ideally, if you can get the cat in your arms, then you'll score more points. This game is very easy to understand, to get to the table. Just need to explain that what you're trying to do is get 7 points, move your little wooden cat to the end of the scoreboard, and hopefully win. It has a weird thing in the game where, you know, the start players, there's a start card, and you can, but literally, if you don't want to worry about the start card,
it's very tedious.
Yeah, put it out on the table anyway, and there's two cards that get taken out that make up this track for the cat, this cardboard cat, to move along. And yeah, you can just randomly pick a, you know, a start player or whatever. But anyway, as you're playing tricks, it is a must follow. So obviously, if the other person's got the same suit, they have to play. When usually the cat is attracted to the winner of the trick, that is the person who's played the highest card, the highest lead card, there isn't a trump suit. And what happens is if the two players both play odd cards, then the cat flips over. It's got a red side and a blue side. And the blue side has got a lovely little pose for the cat, which is slightly different, sort of stretching itself out.
Looks like he's scared trying to run away.
It does, yeah, yeah. The other one's a bit more aggressive. The red side's a bit more aggressive. So on the blue side, when the cat flips over, the cat then moves towards the person who lost the trick. So that is the person who played the lowest card. So you kind of can have it where you've, you know, you're getting the cat and you're thinking, right, you know, the cat's coming towards me and there's nothing you can do about it. And then suddenly, you know, right, the other player pulls the rug out from under you and, you know, you both play odd cards and the cat's now moving towards them and you're trying to flip it back. And there's all sorts of different strategies you can employ to get the cat back. And I just think, Ryan, I don't know if you'd agree, but very simple. But underlying it, there's the back and forth between the two players and the shock value when you're sort of, you know, the cat's suddenly not going their way anymore. It's interesting, right?
Yeah, I will definitely agree that it is simple. It's very, very quick rules, which most of these trick takers card games we talk about generally have quick rules. This is certainly one of the quickest. I'd say, so in like all these games and a lot of the times I always refer to it's a good puzzle or this game has a good puzzle. Trying to figure out when looking at your hand, how can you solve it in the best way? What's going to get you the reward or the outcome you're looking for in the quickest or most efficient or best way, however that game requires you to do it. And I think with Catchy, sometimes you just can't because of it's a rather smaller hand. The odd cards being played and flipping the cat over and the must follow with the shorter suits. Sometimes you just end up having to play a card that you're following off of your opponent and it just goes their way and they win 3 tricks in a row and the cat's in their arms and they've won the round. And like, no matter how you played it, you wouldn't have had a choice because you just had to play what you were playing off of. And I just feel like the puzzle in this game, even when you do have a hand that you have choices with, isn't as open. There are the clever decisions to make of when do you flip the cat over? Do you want it to be on the red side so that the higher card wins, or do you want it to be on the blue side for the lower card to win? But that decision sometimes only happens once or twice in the round. And I think that's where I think for me personally, it lacks a little bit of that puzzle that I'm looking for. Not to say that it's bad overall. I think it's still cute. It's fun. It's charming.
It's definitely
it plays
cute.
Super yeah. quick. Yeah. So I think that's where its merit comes into play. It can be a little mind-numbing in that situation, though. So if you want to be able to play a game after a long day, this might be a good option for that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a micro game, right? You can take it anywhere. But if somebody said to me, you know, does it make my top 10 of trick takers? No. And it's worth keeping in my collection because it's a small little portable game. But I feel like this could get overplayed very quickly. And sometimes what you were saying, Ryan, about the game potentially playing itself, that could very well be the case to an extent, albeit, you know, you're always probably going to have at least a couple of decisions to make when you're playing about what the cat does. So it's in a bit of a weird space, but that being said, light-hearted, charming little game that is quick to play and quick to teach, but very, very cute. So if you like the art, then, or you like cats even, you know, it's potentially a good option.
Yeah. And now moving to the other type of house animal that people usually like, instead of cats, we have dogs. And
what, you're going to say pups again?
I mean, we could. Unfortunately, that's not a two-player only game, but you know I would love to sneak it on the list.
I knew
if
you
I
would.
Could.
Yeah.
But no, we have Peter's two sheepdogs. Before I even talk about anything, I want to talk about the production. This is such a great little production this thing has. There's 3D printed meeples for all of the quote unquote cards in the game. They are all different animals, sheep, cows, pigs, and then there's wolves. And then there's a fenced off area that each player has that's also a little 3D printed fence that you like set up. You like interlock with each other, and you just have these square fences off the side of the board. And then the box itself is the actual game board. You just take the top of the lid and the bottom of the lid, put them next to each other, and then the little insert that comes in the box, you just put inside of each of them. And it's just super cool. It makes a great table presence. And anybody that looks at it always goes, what is that? What is that? What is this game? It looks so neat. So what is it, though? What is Peter's Two Sheepdogs?
What is it? Yeah.
Yeah, well, it is a Mancala trick taker. So the way it works is lead player plays any one, again, quote unquote card. I'll just keep calling them cards, but they are little meeple bits. And they will play any one of the suits. It is must follow. And then regardless of what you actually played, the higher number wins. So I could play a two pig. Patrick doesn't have any pigs, plays seven cow. His seven is higher than my two, so he's winning the trick. Depending on if you win the trick or lose the trick will determine what action you take at the end of the trick. So the winner will take both pieces, both cards that were played, and put them on their side of the board. Then the loser plays Mancala. And you basically take all of your pieces, in case you're not familiar with Mancala, you pick up all of your pieces in one section and then drop them one piece at a time in a clockwise direction, dropping them inside that fence and then on your opponent's side in each spot and then in their opponent's fence and just going around in a circle until you run out of pieces. Depending on where they land after a certain number of tricks, you're going to have a spring scoring phase. And then at the end of the entire hand, all 11 tricks, you're going to have a summer scoring phase. And this is the cool part of the game. If your summer score is less than your spring score, you score nothing for summer. And if your summer score is double your spring score, you double your spring score. And if it's neither of those, your summer score just stays the same. It sounds way more complicated than it actually is when you like look at it and you start to play it through. But ultimately, the idea is that you want to get a lot of points in spring, aka those first five tricks, but not too much. Because if you score too many points, it's really hard to score the same number of points in summer, if not more. If you don't score as many points in the last six tricks, then you don't score any of those points. So as I keep mentioning here, that puzzle, it's really neat of trying to figure out how far do you push yourself? How many points do you get in spring so that it's still feasible to do in summer?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can set, let alone what your opponent's doing, sometimes you can set yourself up for disaster by your own making, you know, or, you know, if you know your opponent's getting a high score, and you might let them get a really high score in the first round in the spring, if you like, so that they're absolutely against the wall in the summer and they've got nowhere to go. And then ultimately, you know, you win. This is a game that we both played, Ryan, together, actually. If you look at it, it essentially looks like Farmville the game or some kind of weird Agricola spin-off, but it's not. It's very much a unique trick-taking game that is currently impossible to find, I believe.
Yes, very hard to find.
But it's very funky to know about and to pick it up and play it. Like Ryan, you said, you know, you've got these fenced areas, you've got these wooden meeples that don't fit in the box, apparently. so I hear. And you're trying to sort of navigate them around the Mancala. You've got the You know, the sheepdogs, wolves, sorry, they're wolves, not sheepdogs.
We are the sheepdogs herding all of
these. We're the sheepdogs. And, you know, there are opportunities for the wolves to cause chaos among your opponent's fences. I think they eat things in fenced areas. Is that right?
Yep. Whenever you drop a wolf into a fenced area, if there's another livestock animal, it eats that livestock, and both the wolf and livestock are removed from the game.
Yeah.
So there's strategic ways where most of the time you'd think on paper, oh, I'm always going to put the wolf in my opponents.
Right,
I'm going to make my opponents so they get less points. Well, actually, sometimes you want to put it in your own fence because maybe your opponent dropped an additional animal in your fenced area so that they score more, making it harder to get those summer points. So you purposely want to lose points to make yourself have a lower score to get for summer.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I wouldn't say it's great for someone who is new to trick taking, but I think if you know the genre and would like a challenge and fancy something different, you know, the Mikala mechanism, Ryan, a mashup of quirkiness, then this is probably going to hit the spot.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's very, as you mentioned, quirky and a little weird that it certainly isn't for everybody, even people who are really into trick taking. So just be mindful of that, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was Peter's two sheepdogs,
which was by Shibu. We didn't say
Shibu. Did we say the name?
I didn't say it. I know I didn't. Shibu.
Shibu. There we go. Thank you, Shibu, for a unique experience. Lastly, on this list, we've got Claim. And Claim is a game, or its claim to fame, derives from apparently German whist originally. That's where the roots lie of Claim. It's a game designed by Scott Alms. And the idea is to essentially play cards or play tricks to acquire your hand to then go into, in the first round, to then go into the second round with the hand that you acquired in the first round and knowledge, or certainly some knowledge at least, about what your opponents have got. Because in the first round, when you're acquiring cards, you know what you're getting, but there is a time where if you lose the trick, you just draw from the top of the deck, and there's some unknown element as well. So you can't always be 100% sure about what the other person is getting, but at least it's better than just a random hand of cards, because you've got more of an insight in that regard. Yeah, open.
Yeah.
Ish information.
Certainly, it's almost like a weird way of to draft. Essentially, you're playing tricks to draft cards.
Yeah, it's like you're not playing the game. You are playing the game, but you're not playing it yet because wait for the second round. And albeit there are some cards that you know you can get in the second, in the first round that help your score, but most of the cards, the card play revolves around the second round, where actually then you are winning tricks. There's different factions. So, for example, there's dwarves, there's knights. I'm worried I'm going to say a completely wrong faction that's not in the game, but that would be weird.
Well, the thing is, there's so many expansions to this game. You could probably name something and it will exist. And
just come up with
the
fantasy
like
characters. It's,
There's like, what, 12 to 15 expansions or something insane?
Yeah, goblins and all sorts. I mean, there are certain cards that beat other cards outright, you know, even if they're a lower value. For example, a knight beats a goblin, apparently, as the folklore goes, right? doppelgangers, you know, that mimic what other cards are. So some really cool asymmetric cards in play. And the idea is essentially to have the majority of factions, a majority of followers in a faction, to win that faction over. So, for example, at the end of the game, if I had the most knights, then I've won the knight faction. And then you, broadly speaking, compare your factions to your opponent's factions. And, you know, if you've got more factions than they've got, then you win the game. It's a funny one, isn't it, Claim? Because there are a hell of a lot of expansions out there. So depending how far down the rabbit hole you want to go, I only ever had the base game. What's your experience with Claim Right?
So I own the base game, and I have two expansions, the reinforcements and maps and something. I haven't actually touched them only because I don't like regular Claim as much.
Okay.
I think it's neat as far as what you're doing. As I said, like the drafting, the playing tricks out to determine what your second hand is the actual important play. Mm-hmm. And as I keep mentioning puzzles, it's a interesting puzzle to figure out when do you try and lose a trick because, you know, the card that's face up, the person winning, isn't something you want. So maybe taking a random card from the draw pile is better. And so with that, I thought the base characters or base factions were unique. They did have some interesting plays. I know because it's the base game and trying to introduce the concept of all of them, they're a little more basic. I think like the Doppelganger is the most complicated faction in there. And when you compare it to some of the expansion ones that I've just like read how they work, it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
So I think it's one claim as a game. I think that you need some of the expansions to make the game more interesting with what they do, because it, some, again, from what I've just read on some of the expansions, they do things additional on top of just playing a card to win the card for your second hand. Like that first round of play where you're normally just playing to create your second hand, there are other factions that do more stuff. So I would love to try it again with one of the expansions and with some of the others to see if that maybe changes my input on it. But as far as base game goes, I think it's just okay.
Yeah,
but I can certainly see the appeal to it, though.
I think it's just fine as well. We played it a few times. I played it with a partner a few times, played it with some other friends a few times. We're like, oh, this is good. You know, after several games, it's okay. You know, I kind of seen it now. That was novel the first time, you know, that my knight took out your goblin. But, you know, I don't know how much mileage it is. And obviously that necessity to buy or acquire the expansions to add that replayability. Personally, I'd probably just rather play a trick taker that has the replayability, in my opinion, inbuilt, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that Claim is a bad game. It's not a bad game. It's just fine, in my opinion. And that's why I moved it on. But, you know, if you like the idea of asymmetrical factions, and, for example, you were looking at Trick Takers, the game with asymmetrical factions, but you only ever had two people, then it's kind of a neat way of getting that into your game nights and, you know, looking at the expansions, etc.
And I kind of want to touch on that, actually, because that's a good point for the expansions and, you know, sort of the need to get them. A lot of the things that's nice about these card games and the trick-taking games is that everything is contained within that one box. The designer, you know, it's a small enough space that it's not a game that really needs expansions. A lot of times you get big, heavy board games. There's so many bits, so many components, so many rules, so many different interactions that they just add more of that stuff in expansions, and it's a normal thing. It's significantly less common and not normal, really, in trick-taking and in smaller card games. It's a one-and-done thing. You might get a second game, like Fox in the Forest and Fox in the Forest Duet, but they're standalone. So a game like Claim, the fact that it's really built upon those expansions. Like, the base game is there as just the primer, but all of those expansions really exist as in the... There's so many different ways to mix and match this game because that's how it almost seems like it was intended to be, is having all of those. So it's just interesting to see a game that uses that format of the expansions to what I could see as its benefit. I mean, sure, it's a downfall because then it forces you to have to buy a bunch of expansions. And it sounds like we're on the same page here, and I don't want to keep rambling on about it, but that if it's a game that requires all the expansions to enjoy it and you can't just enjoy the base game out of it, is it really worth it to go all in on something before you've even tried just the base game?
Right. Okay. And then unlike something like, I know I've said Trick Takers before, we've talked about it a lot on this show, unlike something like Trick Takers, obviously, I think is better with the expansions we said before. But with Trick Takers, you've got generally playing with more people and there's different social dynamics. The characters feel very, very different. Whereas here, you've almost got like a, you've got a communal set of powers, haven't you? Where it's, yeah, you know, everybody's got these cards. Everybody can do these things. And then you condense that down to just two people. And you're kind of a bit limited as to where you can go with that. So I think I haven't played the Claim expansions. I know you said you have, I think.
No, I have two of them. Haven't played them yet.
Sorry, you haven't played them. But yeah.
So this is all a grain of salt. No, I mean, everything we're saying here is just based on us playing the base game. But that's where I think from reading the expansions, they sound cool enough that it might pique my interest more in the game. But it's relying you to get those expansions to have that better experience.
Yeah, they've done what they can in the limitations of the system. And in this case, it's pumping out more content, whether you think that's a good thing or not. You know, that it brings out the inner collector in us. And yeah, it is what it is. But there we go.
Well, that was sort of our list of two-player only Trick Takers that Patrick and I have played recently with each other or with other people. And to sort of continue on here with some two-player only games, we're actually going to do a little head-to-head competition.
Mm-hmm. Juicy.
Yeah. And so the two games that we're going to be talking about here and kind of going in depth and discussing is going to be Violet and the Grumpy Nisa, which was designed by Pedro Pereira, and Jekyll versus Hyde, which was designed by G. O'Neill. And the reason why we wanted to do these two games is because they both have a sort of similar gameplay, game mechanic, functionality to them that has an asymmetrical tug-of-war style of play. And Violet and the Grumpy Nisa was actually a game that the Patrick and I got to play with each other pretty recently. And I know we haven't played Jekyll versus Hyde together, but we've played it a lot, both BGA and PCIO. So I thought it would just be neat to talk about those games, sort of compare and contrast what makes them tick for us, which one do we like better overall, those kind of things. So I'll kick it over here to Patrick to just sort of first go over, I guess we can start with Jekyll versus Hyde and then go from there.
Yeah, sure. Basically, Jekyll versus Hyde, as some of you may be familiar with the novel or, you know, the stuff in folklore. But basically, one of you is Dr. Jekyll and the other is the evil Mr. Hyde. You've got a board in the center of the table. So when we say tug of war, we really mean tug of war. Production's great, but your goal is essentially to move this metal piece to your end of the board. So obviously Jekyll's or Hyde's side of the board. But the way that the tricks are played out are really quite different. So Dr. Jekyll, you're trying to balance the tricks out so that, you know, that the tricks that you win are sort of on par with the amount of tricks that Mr. Hyde or your opponent wins. Whereas Mr. Hyde is very much an all or nothing kind of character, just wants to win all the tricks or hardly, you know, anything at all, so that Dr. Jekyll doesn't get this even keel, this even balance, this even pace of tricks acquired. But of course, if that was all that there was to do, then it probably would be quite bland. But fortunately, there's potion cards. So there's three different suits, and then there's these potion cards which mix things up a little bit. And there's these tokens as well. So the first time a suit gets played in the game, something's going to happen. You're going to put one of these tokens on the game board, and that might change things around a little bit. So, for example, it might reset the trump hierarchy, and that takes all the tokens off, because if all the tokens are out, they're all different colors. Interestingly, that establishes the suit strength. So if anyone who's listening is familiar with games like Boast for Nothing or games where you have hierarchies of, you know, where some suits are stronger than others, you as players playing the game kind of determine that through what cards you play, which is really interesting. there's another card that you can exchange cards with your opponent. I can't remember what the other one does, but...
You take a trick from your opponent that they previously won to your side.
That's right. Ryan to the rescue. Thanks very much. and then there's you've got this color ranking system, and you've got potions as well. And potion cards can cause things to happen as well. So some of those effects which we've been talking about. And it, you know, they've got a plus on them. So, you know, somebody plays a 2, somebody plays a 2 plus, which is a potion card. And obviously the 2 plus is going to have the edge over a 2. So very, very interesting game. One of the first, apart from Fox in the Forest, which isn't really, I guess, that asymmetrical, but one of the first asymmetrical two-player trick-taking games that I've owned and loved. Like I said, the production's off the charts. What do you think of this one, Ryan? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I love this one. The production, as you said, that little token that you use as the piece that goes back and forth on the board is really cool. It's got Dr. Jekyll on one side and Mr. Hyde on the other. So you're like standard facing towards you as it moves closer. But the way that board works, to kind of elaborate on the overall play, is there are 10 spaces in total, and there are 10 tricks in a round. So if Mr. Hyde can go perfect, aka take all 10 tricks or lose all 10 tricks, and they can win in the first round.
Frightening.
Yeah, doesn't happen that often, but in this game, it's normally easier to win as Mr. Hyde than it is as Dr. Jekyll. So I know in the rules they even have a basically play the game twice by players swapping. So like you'll be Dr. Jekyll the first game, then I'll be Dr. Jekyll the second game. And you're trying to see who wins faster as Mr. Hyde, because again, Mr. Hyde normally wins. Not always the case. I don't want us to make it sound like 99% of the time Mr. Hyde's winning. Dr. Jekyll can absolutely win. And this is a game that sort of requires repeat plays, because when you play with two people who are familiar with the game, familiar with the flow and the powers and the hierarchy and how it all plays, it can be really tight. The idea of Dr. Jekyll trying to always get 5 tricks apiece every round starts from the beginning, because at the beginning of the round, depending on where that token is on the board, there are colors on those spaces. The first half is blue for Dr. Jekyll and the second half is red for Mr. Hyde. If it's on a blue space, Dr. Jekyll leads the first trick. Red space, Mr. Hyde leads the first trick. You always want to, as Dr. Jekyll, really to be in control. So you want to make sure it's on that side to be leading, because choosing the suit hierarchy can be really important. Looking at your hand and knowing what suit might be weaker or stronger lets you set the pace of whatever suit you put as the weakest suit. Because if you have the 7s in all of the, you know, the suits and the highest numbers, you could still play a 7 of something, and if your opponent can't follow, and that's the weakest suit, they're going to win no matter what they play. So for example, if purple's the lowest on there, I play a purple 7. Patrick doesn't have any purples. He plays a 3 red. Red's ranked higher than purple. He's winning that trick. So there's a good push and pull there that isn't usually as easy to see a path with Dr. Jekyll. Mr. Hyde is a much easier thing first time you're playing this game, because you just need to win them all, lose them all. Like, you're really playing along with Dr. Jekyll and either ducking the tricks they play or just trying to win over them. Whereas Dr. Jekyll is the one who's really setting all of the pace.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I think I said earlier about these tokens, obviously you're playing the cards to set the hierarchy, like you said. But it's really the potions that cause these effects to happen, isn't it, in the game as well. So a potion card comes out and then, you know, a red card comes out. Okay, the red effect, or a potion and a purple effect. So really neat, isn't it, that you set the hierarchy and then cause chaos at your own discretion, or obviously your opponent plans the chaos for you. Or albeit you could just totally just reset the whole hierarchy and then try and play the cards you've got to your advantage. So does so much with so little. And we talked about catchy earlier. I almost wish that some of this mitigation was in a game like that to stop the game ever falling into the, you know, where it could play out itself. And I don't think this game could, because I think there's so many tools at your disposal. I think it would be very difficult to have no agency.
Yeah, I think what makes those choices open also creates some issues. Because I know it's like with the potions, there's only four of them. And there's actually another thing too, is at the beginning of every round, there are three rounds if you go the full game. You have to pass one card round one, two round two, three round three. And if you have two or more potions, you must pass a potion. So in round two, if you have three potions in your hand, you have to pass two cards. Mm-hmm. You must pass one of the potions, but the second card you pass could be anything. Do you pass another potion? Do you pass another card?
Yep.
You know, things like that. Giving information to your opponent based on what gets passed and stuff also sets up the round, because it's always so funny seeing when Mr. Hyde passes a 7, a 6, and a 5 or whatever. And you're like, okay, they're tossing all of me their high cards. They want to lose a bunch of tricks.
Yeah, get no tricks, right?
Yep. I now know that's what they're going for. How do I make sure they take tricks? And with the potions, kind of going back to that, and the powers that they have, and the resetting the hierarchy, passing cards mid-round, taking tricks from players, it adds a lot in its small package. So while I like that, because this is a great puzzle for me, this game, I usually like playing Dr. Jekyll, because trying to find that balance is really neat. Kind of goes against actually everything I normally do, because I usually just, like, you know, Mr. Hyde sounds more like something I'd go with.
Yeah.
But for this one, it's just, it's really a good time for me when I'm Dr. Jekyll. But I think that planning and overall play, figuring out the suits, when to do what, can be a little overwhelming.
Yeah, give the new person Dr. this is terrible.
Dr. Hyde?
Dr. Hyde, yeah. Give the new person Mr. Hyde you're teaching the game to, right? And then I think I find the puzzle as Dr. Jekyll. I had to check that I was saying it right. Dr. Jekyll more rewarding, because it's the more difficult of the puzzles. I mean, you could totally just flip it over and be like, right, now, you know, you play the other side and we'll there's a definitely a little meta game kind of thing going on here through repeat plays with the same person, I'll add. And obviously, we're going to draw some comparisons with Violet and the Grumpy Niece. So I guess, unless there's anything else you've got on Dr. Jekyll before we make comparisons, Ryan, we should move over to Violet.
Yeah, I think it's good we can start doing some comparisons here with Violet and the Grumpy Niece. Uh-huh. So in that game, one of you is playing as Violet, the other one of you is playing as the Grumpy Niece, which is named Torek. And the comparison here is essentially Dr. Jekyll's probably the closest to Violet, and Mr. Hyde is Torek. The way you're trying to win as Violet is essentially complete your path along this trail. The theme and the story behind the game is Violet is a little girl in town. It's late at night. Her parents have gone to bed, and Violet's sneaking out of the house to go meet her friend in the woods to go on an adventure together.
Friendly troll. Yeah,
the friendly troll. Yeah, troll. Ordep. Yeah. Having a nice little campfire going, waiting for Violet. Well, the grumpy Niece, who was kicked out of the town for being so grumpy, because normally Niece's are very friendly and helpful.
Of course.
Gnome type creatures. Well, Torek was kicked out and sees Violet going into the forest, trying to meet her friend, I'm assuming looking happy, and isn't happy that she's happy, and tries to scare her and make sure she doesn't get to her friend. And this is all done in what you'll probably see from people online or other places say, that this isn't a trick taking, but it is a trick taking. It kind of like is a fine line across it. To me, to simplify it, I would consider it a trick taker. We're both playing a card. You're comparing the strengths of those cards. There is a trump suit. If trump's in, it wins. If not, it's, you know, lead suit wins. It has very similar flow and mechanics to a trick taker, that it's close enough compared to some that are like those simultaneous action selections. But I digress. So with that, the first comparison I want to make is it's a lot easier to win as Torek than it is as Violet. Just like it is easier to win as Mr. Hyde than it is as Dr. Jekyll. Yes. The more you play this, though, just like with Jekyll and versus Hyde, the two players who play the game play it often enough, get familiar with the stuff and the format and the flow, you'll probably see it be a little bit tighter. But I think in this one, Torek is probably still going to win more than Jekyll would when players get better at Jekyll versus Hyde.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, you know, so far I've played this with you through the one time. However, it definitely gives off that vibe because the way the board is engineered, Violet has got lots of spaces to cover to get to the end destination. And throughout that travel that Violet does to get to the end destination, at the end of the forest to meet this troll, there's so many tools at the disposal of Torek to hamper that and, reduce. She's got the light, this torch in her hand, and Torek's trying to make it go out, and she's trying to add fuel to it. And so the theme comes across, by the way, which it does like in Jekyll and Hyde. But yes, I think it just feels quite mean on Violet. Violet seems to be doomed from the start, so much so that I would agree that the puzzle with Jekyll and Hyde, as Dr. Jekyll, got it right that time, is rewarding when you win. But I feel like this game, I feel like when Violet wins in this game, you're going to feel a massive sense of reward because it's such a challenge. I'm not saying, and we're not saying, I imagine that it's impossible to do, of course, just that it's very difficult to do. And so that if you pull it off, it's going to be like, wow, that was tight. Because I don't imagine an ending of this game where Torek's a million miles away.
Yeah, and to give a little more clarification for listeners to understand how that is, when Violet wins a trick, she moves one space along her path. The path is a total of, I can do quick math, 4 times 3. I think it's like 17 or 18 spaces total that she has to move.
Right.
So that's 17 or 18 tricks she has to win. But when Torek wins, Violet is still forced to move a space. But then there's this fear track. There's one way Violet wins by reaching Ordep. There's two ways that Torek wins. It's when fear catches up to Violet or Violet runs out of fuel. When Violet moves one space, when she wins, she uses one fuel. When Torek wins, she uses two fuel. And then the cards in the trick, when Torek wins, go to this fear track. And it's sort of a delayed track that after the third time Torek wins, the cards that were from three tricks ago slide off, and then you compare the difference. And so by that is, let's say I'm Torek and I play a 9, and Patrick is Violet, plays a 2. I win the trick. When those cards slide off that fear track, 9 minus 2 is 7. That difference of 7 is how far my fear marker moves. And there is a separate path on the board that the fear goes before it reaches the same path that Violet's on. But just thinking, being able to move 7 versus moving 1 is a huge difference. Now, that's kind of where we come into the play of, as Violet, you're trying to make your numbers as close as possible. If you know you're going to lose, make sure that spread's not as wide. And if Torek's going to win, make sure the spread is wide. This is another comparison with Jekyll versus Hyde, that balance. Hyde wants it to be as spread as far as possible. Dr. Jekyll wants it to be as close as possible. So you have that same idea, but it's in individual tricks in Violet versus the whole round with Jekyll versus Hyde.
Right. And the difference, when we're talking about trick differences as well, that's very clear cut in Jekyll and Hyde. Jekyll versus Hyde, you want Dr. Jekyll wants the differences in the tricks as a balance. Whereas in this game, you've got that whole mechanic with differences in number of the cards played into a trick causing Violet to move, which can be really, really dooming for the person who's playing Violet, because all of a sudden you could be playing really well and that one trick, where there's like an 8 or 9 difference, can really throw you off kilter. albeit the board is, you know, 17, 18 spaces, and you've got less ground to cover, you know, the 10 tricks in Dr. Jekyll versus Hyde. And for that reason, the game seems to take a little bit longer as well, doesn't it? I mean, Jekyll versus Hyde, you can do that quite quickly, sort of, I don't know, 5-10 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. Whereas this one, you kind of feel like you're in it for the duration.
Yeah, I'd say this is more of a heavy stay. You're playing Violet for, you know, 30, 45 minutes, whereas Jekyll versus Hyde, I think it's probably a little more than 10 minutes, probably more like 15, 20, depending on how, you know, AP somebody might get. But yeah, certainly much quicker than Violet and the Grumpy Nisa. And one other thing I didn't mention, too, is in Violet, you don't actually, your hand's not randomly dealt to you. You draft your hand. Similar to Voltreffer, if you've ever played that game before, there's a tableau of four cards out, and you pick that card up into your hand, you refill the tableau, then another person picks the card. So you actually get to know what your opponent has in their hand. There are some powers on some of the cards, though. So another comparison between the two games, there are certain abilities or powers that trigger. The difference with Violet, though, is they happen more often, because as long as you don't play a card of the Trump suit, which the Trump suit is determined by that track we keep talking about, when Violet's pawn is on a color, whatever that color is Trump for the game until she goes on to a new color.
Beautiful landscape, Ryan. We've got mountains and trees and all sorts of things on Violet's adventure, right?
We do, yeah. Yeah, the suits match with the different part of her adventure that she's in, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure.
So the decision of, do you play a card for its Trump suit to win the trick, or do you play it, you know, off Trump to make sure that you trigger the ability because maybe you want new cards? Because some of those abilities allow you to draw cards off the deck or take cards from the discard pile. So now you have hidden information of cards that are in your hand because you didn't draft it off from the tableau.
Yeah, it's like you can know the other person's hand but not know the other person's hand. In, again, Jekyll versus Hyde, you've got the card passing that you do. This is generally more open. You've got more knowledge because of the card drafting, like you were saying. There's only a few cards on the table, but you've got more of an idea. Depending on the powers that your opponent uses to change their hand around a little bit, this game, I would say, is more reliant on memory's power in this game to an extent as well. You know, knowing what cards your opponent's taking, getting to know what the abilities do. There are more of them than in Jekyll versus Hyde, where you've only got, it's the three abilities, and the trump can be quite dynamic. Whereas in this, it's more abilities, but the trump, like you said, is relevant to the board. It's a different feel in that sense. And that's really where the, you know, with the Voltreffer kind of draft, as you were saying, the games kind of diverge off in down different paths a little bit, for me anyway.
Yeah, no, and I think a short story that I want to share here is I actually got the chance to play Violet with the designer, Pedro, and that was super cool. That was a very neat experience. To be able to play a game by the designer, no matter what the game is always great, because of the fact that you get to see it in the perspective and the understanding of why this mechanic's here or what this is doing. Or in my situation, seeing how you can play Violet very efficiently.
Oh, well, that's always good to know. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I will say, in that game as Torek, I ultimately won. So
that was great. You beat the designer. So
yeah, that felt great. But I will tell you, there was a point where he was just toying with me. Okay. So as we mentioned, when Violet wins a trick and she decides to move forward, she spends one fuel. But you can actually choose, instead of moving forward, when Violet wins, you can gain three fuel back in your lantern. So when Torek wins, you're forced to move, you're forced to spend two fuel. So if Torek keeps winning, or even if you keep winning as Violet and you keep moving forward, you're eventually going to get low on your fuel, and that's another way that Torek wins. So you have to make the decision at some point during the journey to regain fuel. You have to. You just can't not. You won't get far enough to do so. So when do you do that? Well, obviously every game's going to be different just based on outcomes and trick plan stuff. But there was a point where I was down to getting Violet to maybe 4 pips left of their fuel. And we were on the pink space of the board, which is like the last 6 spaces. And Pedro ended up winning that trick to move into the pink area and then just took control and was just winning, I think, like 5 or 6 tricks in a row, not moving and just gaining fuel and got all the way back to full fuel.
Wow.
And like I was, and the thing is, because at that point, like I had won a few tricks before that. The fear had moved like 5 spaces, 6 spaces. And then I was getting like 0 and 0. But then he just started winning. And like, so I was feeling good and confident. And then I started getting really worried that, oh my God, full fuel now with only like 4, 5, 6 spaces or whatever it was to go. Like, there's no way I'm going to do this. But because of that nature of the tableau and cards flipping, there is a little bit of luck in there on what cards come out. And by the time he was ready to start moving again, the flop came out nicely for me, and I was able to get the 9 trump card that got me to win that trick. Because actually, I don't know if I even said this about any of it, but it's a may follow game. You can play any card at any time and whenever you want.
Yeah, I don't think we said.
Yeah. So that's a big decision in the game. Because like I mentioned, playing a trump card for trump ability or playing a non-trump for its power. Well, at that point, I had the 9 trumps. So no matter what, I was going to win the trick because Pedro didn't have a 1, which that ability is, it beats the 9s.
Right.
So I was guaranteed to win that one. And then it set me in the precedence of being in the lead, and the differences of cards just kind of like the space and the fell apart and fear caught up to him really quickly. But ultimately what I'm trying to get at here, which I know that wasn't a short story, is that it was just really cool to see Violet played in a way that in my first 2 plays that I played it before playing it with Pedro, just to see how his thought process of Violet's journey of when he was winning tricks, when he was choosing to lose tricks, because in this game, just like Dr. Jekyll wants to win and lose some because it needs to be balanced, you have to do the same thing with Violet. You can't win everything all the time. You need to accept that. When do you do that? At what points do you let Torek win? And you know, when do you start pushing? It was really cool. But because of the fact that this game is much longer overall than Jekyll versus Hyde, it's harder to analyze when that happens.
Right. Would you say then, I mean, if we're comparing the 2 games in turn, we say, okay, well, side by side and in terms of preferences, but I just want to ask you before we go into that discussion, interesting story, by the way, with the designer. It's great to see how the designer plays, of course, as well. It sounds like he was toying with you a lot there, Ryan. And who knows if he could have won and whether he just decided to, succumb to your trick-taking powers. Do you feel the sense of euphoria if you win with what Violet? Do you think that will be greater than, you know, winning as Dr. Jekyll, playing Dr. Jekyll versus Hyde?
Yeah, I would think so. Having played Jekyll versus Hyde more, I've won as Dr. Jekyll, and it feels good, but yeah. I've played Violet in the Grumpy Nisa 4 times now, played Violet twice, and in all 4 games, Torek has won. And right. The thing is, Violet usually gets to around the same area every time. She's right. Usually in that pink zone or the section right after the pink zone, which again, it's about the last 6 spaces of the game. So you tend to make it far enough to where you feel like you might have it, or you know, like I've gone as far as I can, but there's just no way. I know the fear is going to catch up to me and it feels like a defeat. So being able to make it to that point in all 4 games that I've seen is okay. So being able to actually make it all the way would be amazing. It would feel good. And I think that Jekyll versus Hyde being a shorter game, because of that, the win would be, I don't know how I'm trying to word this properly, but I feel like it's a quicker win. Like with Violent and the Grumpy Nisa, you're there for the long haul. So if you're there for 45 minutes and you can eke out that win, which is very difficult, it's going to feel even more rewarding.
Of course. It sounds a bit like, you know, those toy machines with the claws, and you press the button and then it kind of grabs it and then you're almost there and it's about to drop it and oh no, it's dropped it again. Obviously, when you do eventually win one, most of them are rigged, right? Most of them are impossibly difficult. Not to say that this game is, but it sounds like that kind of feeling of satisfaction when you finally get something you've been going after and really trying to work on. Time commitment wise, yeah, of course, you know, the payoff is going to feel better from a time investment perspective anyway. So then I guess the ultimate question is, based on your plays, caveat, right, based on your plays at the moment and your understanding of the two games, if you had to choose between Jekyll vs. Hyde and this game and Violet, which would you be reaching towards? Difficult question, of course.
It is. Yeah. It's a difficult question. I knew that this question would be coming, yeah, too, and I still don't know if I'm prepared for it because it really depends on the mood I'd be in, the fact that one's so much shorter than the other. Mm-hmm. But if having to be dead set on picking one of the two, I really think I would go with Violet and the Grumpy Nisa. I love the tableau, the, you know, drafting your cards. It's a super neat and unique thing in Voltreffer, and I love to see it in another one. The way the flow of the game works on how Trump changes throughout the game, and that you can see and sort of plan for that. Whereas Jekyll versus Hyde, it's a little more dynamic and a little bit, I don't want to say chaotic, but you choosing the order it goes is cool, but then it getting wiped when a red potion happens and then starting again, it can be a little more or a little less predictable than Violet and Grumpy Nisa. But I just think the decisions made in Violet throughout the entire game is more interesting than Jekyll versus Hyde. And it's by the slightest amount. I still really enjoy Jekyll versus Hyde. Like I said, it's a tough decision between the two, but that's what I'd go with. And so what about you?
Yeah. So for me, it's Violet and the Grumpy Nisa, if I had to choose. And a part of the reason for that, Ryan, is because it's new, right? Because it's new to me. And this hobby is always like, well, you know, new thing to you. It's more than that, though, of course. It's, I feel the story of Violet, the theme coming through a bit more. I love what Mandu Games did with the production on Jekyll versus Hyde, by the way. Pumping out some great stuff and the stuff to look forward to. But with Violet, I, you know, this Nordic theme, this having this troll, love the story of it, love going through the, you know, the beautiful board and the may follow and the fact that, you know, you're not pigeonholed. If you want to use a power, you can. And also having the drafting element, not all games get the drafting element right. Sometimes having the drafting element can make the game more convoluted and add length to it. You know, Wash Stick, for example, good game, but drafting takes a long time. This game, the drafting's short, but just gives you enough information to have something to go on that's not in, you know, Jekyll and Hyde. So for me, this game, for the challenge of playing Violet, the challenge of playing Violet wasn't there and it was really easy to kind of do it that way as well, not sure I would be as interested because it's that much harder to do it. Jekyll and Hyde for the length would win if I wanted a quick game, but this game as an overall package, I think it's really enticing. Love what Pedro's done. And he didn't pay us for this, by the way. This is our honest opinion. So for that reason, yeah, my choice is the same as you. And yeah, interesting, we've both chosen this over Jekyll and Hyde, which is a brilliant, brilliant two-player game, by the way. Hopefully we conveyed that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think you sort of touched on it too, and it might also be part of it. Just it's a newer game. It's the newer one. I've played Jekyll versus Hyde a lot already. When it first came out, you know, the things that it does and all these games, you know, when we discover a new game, a unique twist to something, that piques our interest. And that's what's, you know, in our brain. That's what we're thinking about more often and wanting to go back to that one. And it's possible there's a little bit of that. But I think even if I discovered both of them at the same time, what makes Violet so unique and makes me think about that game just ekes out a little bit more than what makes me excited about Jekyll versus Hyde.
Yeah. Jekyll versus Hyde, great game, but if I'm looking at the shelf and I eventually acquire Violet, which I intend to do, I feel like I would find myself reaching for that. If I had, you know, the same amount of time to play a game, I feel like I'd find myself reaching for it. And I probably wouldn't give the person who's new to the game the role of Violet just because they might, you know, not really know the nuances. They might. I feel like a good warm-up character is to give them Toric. I'm not sure if you agree, but yeah.
I mean, I think to some degree it would. Same yeah. thing with Jekyll versus Hyde. You know, give them Mr. Yeah. Hyde because it's a little bit easier to navigate. So I'd agree with that.
Cool. Yeah.
And I think that's probably enough information between the mm-hmm. two. We'd love to hear which game you'd pick between the two if you've had a chance to play them both, or even after just our conversation, which one you'd think you'd like more. You can always reach us at Twitter at TrickTalkers or by email at TrickTalkers@gmail.com. And as we have been saying a bunch lately, we have a Patreon page. We truly love the support and everything that you do with listening to us. And if you want to contribute whatever that amount may be towards the Patreon page, you can head over to patreon.com/TrickTalkers. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. You've been listening, I guess. You've been listening to Trick Talkers. Here comes that awkward outro again.
Awkward
I love it.
Outro, yes.
Yeah. Well, it just we talk about the Patreon part, and it just weirds me out. It's so
it's been so nice having you in our company for today. Yeah, I couldn't get more awkward than that.
Absolutely. We hope you appreciate the episode and look forward to listening to our next one. But otherwise, I'm Ryan.
I'm Patrick.
And I don't know why. I'm
Patrick.
Why do I do
in case you didn't know.
Yep. Thanks so much for listening.
Bye for now.
Bye. Cheers.